Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, we started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dora Williams singing the Solartopia song here with Pete Seeger and David Burns. We have a show today that's really going to raise some issues here because Donald Trump appears to be the presumptive nominee for the Republican race for the presidency, and I am frankly relieved. My biggest fear was Paul Ryan. I've mentioned this on the show before, written about it. I was and am terrified of Paul Ryan. I think he would have been an unbeatable candidate, frankly. He is about as evil as they get, as far as I'm concerned. Not that Donald Trump is any great shakes in any way, shape, or form, and anything less than being evil, but the fact of the matter is that he is not the corporate zombie, Ayn Rand fanatic, totally right-wing, young, decent-looking, credible-looking kind of guy. Donald Trump's actually the same age that Ronald Reagan was when Reagan was elected president in 80. Donald Trump is 69. Hillary is 68, for God's sakes. And, of course, Bernie is 74. So this is a clack of old people we're dealing with here. Just by way of disclosure, I'm 70 myself. So not exactly speaking to you from the kindergarten. But nonetheless, what prompted me to call Margaret Flowers. Margaret, are you on the line here?
Yes, I am, Harvey. How are you?
Great. How are you? It's really good to have you. Good to hear your voice. It's been quite a while.
Thank you. Yes.
So, what prompted me to think of you as Donald Trump has become the presumptive nominee, which is what they're calling him these days, is that he immediately, the first thing out of his mouth, as far as I could tell, is that Hillary is responsible, of course she partly is responsible, having been first lady at the time, for what Donald, I guess we can call him, referred to as the worst trade deal ever negotiated. By which he meant NAFTA. Now, I won't say that I'm not going to compare it to other trade deals, but I will say that NAFTA is clearly, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, one of the worst things that's ever happened to the United States of America. I mean, NAFTA has absolutely gutted in terms of its industrial base, in terms of its wage structure, in terms of its entire equitable system of equity, such as we might seem to have in this country. And now, of course, we're looking at the
Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Partnership. There we go. Peter Piper picked a peck of Trans-Pacific Partnerships. And I would like, I tend to do this. I do not generally like to describe my guests. If you will tell the folks that are listening here who you are and what you do, and because I know you well and you are a spectacular activist, I couldn't begin to describe you. So if you'd be comfortable describing yourself, and then let's launch into a discussion of NAFTA and of the Pacific Partnership and where we stand with it and how you think this is all going to play out. Because this, to me, is actually a really huge deal, and I think that Donald is going to get some serious traction on this. So, Margaret Flowers, tell us where we're at.
Great, thank you. Yeah, so just to introduce myself briefly, I'm in Baltimore, Maryland, so I definitely can see the impacts of NAFTA. We're still living that today in our city. I'm a pediatrician by training, but I'm co-director of popularresistance.org, a daily movement news website, and we work on a broad range of campaigns. The campaign to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership is one that we've been focused on for about 5 years or so now, and more recently I'm running for U.S. Senate as now the officially nominated Green Party candidate for the state of Maryland. So NAFTA was, that was 1994 that went into effect. It was Mexico, Canada, and the United States. And that was really like our first experience with this model of trade on a large scale. And so we really saw how not only did it just devastate the Mexican economy, but it really resulted in outsourcing or moving much of our manufacturing base outside of the country where there was lower labor costs and lower worker protections. And so this whole model of trade that's been used since then has produced every time the same results. And now with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we're at a whole new level. This modern model of trade is even worse than the one we had before in the last century.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning here with NAFTA. In the 92 election, we had a three-way race. NAFTA was on the table. And NAFTA is a trade deal, and we'll get into some detail, which you will do way better than me. So I'm going to defer to you on that. But let's recall the scene here. George H.W. Bush was president of the United States, and he favored NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, but clearly was not going to get it through because the Democrats, by and large, opposed it. And it was clearly designed to benefit the large corporations, to turn over control of our trade policy to corporate executives who are completely unaccountable to anybody and obviously are going to serve their own agendas and overrule whatever democracy we might have had. So H.W. Bush in 91 had 91% approval ratings, having just smashed Saddam Hussein, gotten him out of the Kuwait oil fields in 4 days, and all that stuff. Nobody thought that George H.W. Bush was going to lose. Bill Clinton comes in. He runs, for Prez. He's the hot young Elvis from Arkansas. Gets on the Arsenio Hall show with his sunglasses and plays the saxophone for a couple minutes, and everybody loves him. But he is a new corporate Democrat and decides that he is also going to be in favor of NAFTA. Then we get a third-party candidate, who I think is living proof that extraterrestrials exist, Ross Perot, is about 4 feet high, squeaky voice, billions of dollars, and he is against NAFTA. And he talks about this giant sucking sound that NAFTA is going to produce with all the jobs leaving America. Do you think Ross Perot had the right analysis of NAFTA, Margaret Flowers?
He was absolutely correct, because basically what it did was it allowed corporations to go into Mexico, move their manufacturing base to Mexico, where there's no way that people living in the United States could compete with the low prices for labor down there, as well as what they did in terms of grabbing land and also, undermining workers' rights, exploiting the workers down there. And so we saw so much of the manufacturing move there. We also saw things like, the price of corn falling in Mexico as it opened up the door for American corn, which is corn that's made in the United States, grown in the United States, which is heavily subsidized, to also flood the market in Mexico with lower priced corn that Mexican farmers couldn't compete with because it was below what it cost them to grow the corn. And so in many ways, we saw that the NAFTA not only devastated the manufacturing base in the United States, but it really devastated the agricultural base in Mexico and has created a lot of the problems that they continue to suffer with down there now.
Right. So what happened basically, I guess, was that NAFTA lowered the barriers for corn and allowed the corporate farmed corn from the great Midwest here to flood
right.
into Mexico, wipe out the family farmed corn in Mexico. Is that a fair assumption, assessment?
That's correct. That's correct. So, our lower priced factory farmed corn, large monoculture corn up here in the U.S. then flooded their market.
So tell us.
And one thing it did, that created a nice base of workers in Mexico who were willing to work for very low wages because they really had no other alternatives.
Right. And tell us, if you would then, Margaret, give us the nuts and bolts of NAFTA. What exactly how exactly, because you know, like, I assume that the TPP is not all that different from NAFTA in many ways. I'm sure there are plenty of serious, significant differences. But NAFTA is, along with the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, which is based in Europe, what is the essence of these trade agreements? What is the mechanics of these trade agreements that cause such havoc?
So the goal of these trade agreements, and they're all similar in this, is to really give corporations greater power to move their business, to move their capital, to get access to resources more easily. And so the way that they're written, the language is that they're trying to reduce tariff and non-tariff barriers. So tariffs are, you know, what people pay to import or export goods, and they want to lower those to make it easier for goods to, you know, move across borders. But they're also concerned about what they call non-tariff barriers, which are laws that are put in place to protect workers, to protect public health, or protect the environment. Those are things that, because they cost corporations money, they're seen as barriers to their ability to make a profit. So, you know, for instance, things like there was a huge case in Australia around wanting to put labeling on cigarette packages to let people know about the dangers of smoking. And Philip Morris saw that as a huge threat to their ability to make a profit, because if people actually knew what cigarettes did, they may be less inclined to buy them. And so part of these agreements, and the World Trade Organization is a big part of this as well, is that they create the ability for corporations to sue governments if the laws that we put in place interfere with their profits. And so I guess your listeners may be very familiar with the one that's going on right now under NAFTA, which is because President Obama did not permit TransCanada to build the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. When shortly after Obama denied that permit, TransCanada filed a lawsuit under NAFTA against the United States for $15 billion. So that's kind of, they're really about giving corporations greater power to do whatever they want and to have control over our laws.
Well, let's trace these. Which came first, the World Trade Organization or the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade?
That's a good question. They were all around the same time, kind of right there in the mid-90s.
And did GATT come before NAFTA?
Well, NAFTA was 94.
Okay. So we have what happened, and tell me if I'm characterizing this correctly. What's happened is that the World Trade Organization, the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, the NAFTA infrastructure, and the proposed TPP essentially give a set of boards which are run by corporate executives who determine our trade policy and who can overrule local denials of various permits and local attempts to place tariffs on trade. Is that correct?
Well, so you know, the tariffs that are written into these agreements, and they're actually, tariffs are pretty low in general. They're trying to get them down even lower, but they're generally pretty low. But I would say that these agreements are not so much about tariffs as they are about the other pieces, what they see as non-tariff barriers. And it's interesting because I was able to kind of listen into a group that was of people that, you know, work on these issues recently and hear kind of their whole mindset. And so from the corporation's mindset, if we do something to protect public health and that undermines their profits, that doesn't make sense to them. They can't understand how we would want to protect people's health when it interferes with profits. So things that they were talking about were, but people want to know what's in their food. They want to know if it's made with GMOs. But if we label them with GMOs, then some people who don't like that won't buy it. So that's a negative to them. Or they're concerned about sustainability, that, governments might actually start caring about sustainability and trying to pass laws that require you know, more goods and products to be made locally, and that would be a problem for us because then we can't, you know, have access to those markets. It's all about having access to markets, no matter what the impact of that is. So in some ways that these new agreements impact our laws is, first, under group, you know, things like NAFTA and the WTO, when governments know that they can face a lawsuit over a law that they pass to protect public, then it makes them think twice about whether they want to go through passing that law and then, you know, having a court case and having to potentially spend tens of millions of dollars defending that, as I think Australia spent $50 million to protect their ability to educate people about tobacco.
The government of Australia had to spend $50 million to win a court case to allow them to label cigarettes?
Right, and it's interesting because in general, the governments mostly lose these cases. But and so Australia won not by going to the tribunal, kind of facing the issue of the, you know, whether it was a non-trade barrier to label their cigarettes, but they were fortunately able to win on a procedural point because they argued that the law that they passed about labeling the cigarettes was passed before that agreement was signed. And so they were able to, it's supposed to be that corporations can challenge new laws that we pass and if they affect or impact their profits. But under things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the Atlantic version or TTIP, they actually have in there that corporations are supposed to be notified by governments about pending legislation that may impact them so that they have a chance to weigh in on, you know, how they feel about that particular legislation. So it also gives them the ability to just be in there right from the very beginning and, you know, be working to make that legislation be in their favor.
God, I mean, you know, it's outrageous. I mean, these trade agreements, and of course, as you know, Margaret, and many of our listeners, I'm sure, know, treaties take precedence over pretty much anything else.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, that's something that your listeners may really care about is the impact that things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and TTIP would have on the climate crisis. Because as we know, the Paris Agreement, as historic as it is, it's a voluntary agreement. You know, countries are not required to meet the commitments that they made, not required by law. But the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the TTIP, if they come into effect, are law. And so they have to be enforced. And some of the things that they do is really, you know, they streamline the process to export oil and gas. So they're really written to, you know, we have such a glut kind of oil and gas in this country because the prices have fallen and companies are dying to export these things to other countries where they can sell them at a higher price. And so the TPP and TTIP would streamline that. As well as things like the TPP bans what we call Buy America. So if we wanted to say that we had an enlightened president who wanted to actually do what was necessary and create, you know, a large-scale mobilization of manufacturing and putting into place renewable energy infrastructure, and we wanted to produce those goods here in the U.S. to build up our manufacturing and not have to transport them all over the world, which makes a lot more sense, then foreign corporations would be able to challenge that, and they have to be given equal precedence to what we give to locally made. And so that starts with the TPP, that starts at the federal level right away, but within 3 years, that has to also be enforced at the local level.
God, it's devastating. This is Margaret Flowers talking to us about the trade agreements. So when NAFTA came in, let's go back now and to the election of 1992. Of the three candidates, Perot was the only one who opposed NAFTA, but I'm going to venture a guess here and say that if Bush had won, NAFTA wouldn't have passed. Do you think that's true?
That's a great question. I wish I could go. I wish I could have a good answer for that, but I don't.
Well,
but it was certainly interesting
that.
that Clinton was able to, you know, push that through. But I don't think a lot of people really understood what the full ramifications of that are. I think one of the reasons that we're able to create such great opposition right now to the TPP is that we now have more than 20 years of experience with NAFTA. So people really know how it, you know, lost us hundreds of thousands of jobs and lowered, you know, wages, has really driven a race to the bottom.
Yeah, it's been a catastrophe. So I'm going to say, you know, as a historian, that I think that if Bush 1 had won, if George H.W. Bush had been reelected, that NAFTA would not have gotten through. I don't think there's any way he could have got it through because the Democrats would have opposed it. Clinton comes in as a corporate Democrat. There were left Democrats, including Bernie Sanders, who opposed NAFTA. And, you know, and Ross Perot had really laid the groundwork for opposition.
Yeah.
So Perot called for two things. He called for defeating NAFTA and for balancing the budget. Clinton did balance the budget, you know, cutting welfare and slashing benefits to people, but he also pushed through NAFTA. And Margaret, what were the immediate impacts of NAFTA? Well, let me ask you real quickly a structural question here. How are people chosen to get on these trade boards? Who chooses who runs these organizations?
Are you talking about like the United States Trade Representative and the International Trade Commission? Or?
Yes, I mean, who makes the decisions that are involved, that are empowered by these trade deals?
Right, so these are, you know, trade negotiators, and the U.S. Office of the U.S. Trade Representative is part of the, you know, executive administration. And so the people that work there are chosen, you know, and hired by the administration. There are also, in addition to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, which, you know, they go and do the negotiations, there's also the U.S. International Trade Commission, which has five commissioners that are appointed by the president as well. And when we look at the backgrounds of the people that are chosen, you know, these are kind of your typical, what we see in Washington, you know, your Wall Street financiers, big corporate lobbyists. So the current U.S. Trade Representative, Michael Froman, came out of Citigroup and was given a huge bonus when he left Citigroup to go work for the U.S. Trade Office. And I'm sure that he's, you know, if the TPP goes through, they'll be paid many times over for that bonus that he was given.
Oh, my God. So does the Congress have to approve our trade representatives, or are they just presidential appointment?
They're just, I believe, presidential appointment, or, you know, presidential hires, yeah.
So we have representatives basically from the corporations who are on the NAFTA board. And I assume that includes representatives from Canada and Mexico as well, correct?
Well, if you're talking about the tribunal, are you talking about the tribunal?
Well, who makes the decisions that give NAFTA?
Okay,
so
the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative is the one that negotiates the trade deals and the trade agreements, and then they do have to be approved by Congress. Although the president and Clinton had this for NAFTA, had a process called Fast Track, which allowed him to push it through Congress with very little debate, with no amendments, and then just an up or down vote within a tight time period, so that members of Congress didn't really even have time, if they were willing, to read it and understand the implications of the agreement. But then in addition to that, there's this whole governance structure that that when a corporation wants to sue a government over what it sees as barriers to profit, it goes to this trade tribunal. And those cases, it's like an arbitration case, first off. So it's not like the government really gets to argue its side. And these lawyers that serve as judges in that tribunal, they're considered to be experts, but they're basically corporate lawyers who leave their job with a corporation and go serve as a judge, and then after that case is over, they can go back and work as a corporate lawyer again. So they can actually make a decision in a case that may favor the corporations that they work for in the future. So it's a very, very rigged type of system, and that's why most of the time when cases are brought before the tribunal, the corporations win and the government loses.
Okay, so we've got that set up. So tell us now what you think the impact of NAFTA has been on the American economy and American workers, and then we'll segue into the TPP.
Yeah, what we've seen is that following NAFTA, we have lost, I've seen estimates of 600,000 to a million jobs overall in the United States. I mean, here in Baltimore, where I live, we lost our whole steel industry, and that devastated neighborhoods that continue to struggle to this day, that the after effects of that. You know, if we look at the auto manufacturing and how much of that was then moved out of the country and devastating, you know, large portions of the Rust Belt. So these have had, you know, we look at Flint, Michigan or Detroit. I mean, NAFTA caused that destruction that we're seeing there, and it continues to this day. You know, just recently, Carrier, which is an air conditioning manufacturer, decided that it was going to move its manufacturing down to Mexico, not because they were struggling and they weren't making a profit, but just because they knew they could make even more profit if they moved that manufacturing. And so there go hundreds of jobs.
How exactly did NAFTA cause this to happen?
Well, because it basically allowed... it opened up the border to corporations to be able to do that.
Okay, so before NAFTA, these companies could not just pick up and leave?
Right, it was much harder to be able to just pick up and leave.
Oh, God. Okay, so now, and so Donald Trump essentially is correct when, I don't know that it's the worst trade deal ever signed, and of course the implication is that he could have gotten us a better deal than NAFTA. And, you know, I don't want to go there. But he, in the coming campaign, I'm sure, is going to have a strong case to make against Hillary for her role in NAFTA. Now, what about that? I'm sorry, what about the TPP? Where does the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, fit in all this?
It's interesting because he is, you know, saying that he opposes the TPP, but he thinks he could negotiate a better TPP deal. He's not really giving any indication of what kind of deal he would negotiate. You know, who would he make that one better for? But he does seem to at least talk about the impacts that these trade agreements have had on the manufacturing base in the United States, and seems to recognize kind of the devastation that has done. Hillary Clinton, you know, she actually helped negotiate the TPP, and I think it really is a testament to the movement that's grown up in the U.S. opposing it, as well as having someone like Sanders, who was out there just from the get-go criticizing the TPP, and he has been a long critic of it in Congress. And so that's forced Clinton to actually have to move her position and say that now she's has a lot of concerns about it now that she's actually looked at it. But I don't think anybody has any real belief, and I know that the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is banking on that if she were elected president, that she would be for the TPP, and she would have to find some sort of a way to nuance that so that she could actually support it. But it has made the presidential race right now has made it impossible for Congress to do a vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership before the election. So that's actually a very good thing.
Well, here's the $64 trillion question. If Hillary is elected, do you think that she'll turn around and pass the TPP?
I think that it would be difficult for her to, she would have to find a way that she could sell it to the people. But I think in her kind of ideology and her, you know, close connections to Wall Street and her support for it in the past, I think that in her heart she actually would support the TPP. She just had to find a way to get past kind of the political difficulties of it right now because so many people are against it.
Well, what would the TPP do to America that NAFTA hasn't already done?
So the TPP goes, you know, farther than NAFTA does. We call it NAFTA on steroids, and there's a number of ways. I mean, part of it is that, you know, it's 29 chapters, but only about four or five of those are traditional trade chapters. The other chapters have to do with all these things that large corporations have wanted to get through Congress, but they couldn't get them through the front door, so they're sneaking them through under the TPP. So things like patent protections, like pharmaceutical companies being able to get very extended patent protections for their medication so they can keep the prices high, and putting real barriers in place to companies being able to make generic medications that would be more affordable. Things like deregulating finance so that, you know, capital funds can move more easily in and out of borders, and preventing further regulation of finance. There's a lot of stuff around kind of internet issues, of turning internet service providers into kind of copyright police to, you know, watch what users are doing, and you know, if we make a cute cat picture that maybe the cat's not ours or something, we can get in trouble for doing something like that. All the kind of creativity that we see on the internet right now would be really impacted under the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And then it does, the ban on Buy America is really concerning. Okay. Forcing procurement, you know, government procurement to not be able to prioritize buying things, goods and services that are made in the United States. And the fact that that will even move down into the local level will impact our own towns and cities. You know, if we want to have farm to table or something like that, then we may, you know, that may be challenged. We may not be able to do that. The tribunal, they kind of have given more power to more corporations. So they've opened up the kinds of corporations that can sue governments in the trade tribunal. They've opened that up to many more corporations. So something like 9,000 new corporations have that ability to sue. And they can sue not just for money they've lost, but they can sue for money that they expected to lose. So, you know, say a fracking, you know, if a fracking company was going to come in and frack an area and they expected to make so many tens of billions of dollars from fracking that particular area, and a community says, no, you can't do that, they can sue for the money that they were going to make.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. No, I wish I was kidding you. It's really, this is a 21st century trade model, and it's even worse than the one we had in the last century. And that's why it's so imperative. There are three agreements that are being negotiated right now. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is the first one. It's been completed and it's been signed and it's just waiting ratification. The second one is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. That's being negotiated with Europe. And then the third one is even actually the biggest and the scariest. And that's more than 50 countries, and it's called the Trade and Services Agreement. And basically that would privatize our economy. So services would be privatized. Think the Postal Service, think education, think healthcare. It would drive privatization of those in a way that would be irreversible. And we know when these types of services become privatized, they do not care about the people who need those services. What they care about is where they can get the most profit. And so it's really important that we protect these things that we consider to be public goods. We need schools. We need healthcare. We need the Postal Service to deliver our mail. We have to protect those by stopping these agreements.
God almighty. We're joined by Bob Fatakis. Bob, you with us? Bob Fatakis, you there? Well, I guess not. Well, Margaret Flowers, this is terrifying stuff. I hadn't heard about these. Was that? Okay, so...
Yeah.
Okay. Bob, you're here.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you've been hearing Margaret Flowers. This is Bob Fatakis, my co-conspirator.
Hello, Bob.
We have an upcoming book.
Hi.
We have an upcoming book coming out next week called The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016. And we were going to talk about that, but Margaret is really so articulate and powerful on these trade agreements. Bob, have you been following these trade agreements at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had the privilege of fighting the Clintonistas in 1992. I was Governor Jerry Brown's spokesperson on NAFTA, which pretty much destroyed my political career. I was running against John Kasich for Congress. And again, I was told we needed to leave it out of the platform, that it would cause no harm, and that Clinton wasn't even thinking about it. So and now you've got the TPP. So I've been watching carefully, you know, at this, you know, neoliberal wing that believes that free trade is going to save the world when it's doing the exact opposite.
Well, we opened the show, and I'm going to raise this with you as a political scientist. I mean, I remember very, very clearly the 1992 election. And as I recall, George Bush the first, the incumbent, supported NAFTA. But there was no way in hell he was going to get it passed.
Right.
Because he was a Republican. And then
there was talk that Clinton was the Trojan horse.
And then, yes, and Clinton supported it. Ross Perot opposed it, very adamantly opposed it. And listening to Margaret very accurately predicted what would happen to the United States if NAFTA got in. And so in comes Clinton, and Clinton, being the Democrat, was able to divide the Democratic Party and put NAFTA through. Is that an accurate characterization of what happened?
One of the parts we ought to consider, too, at the platform hearings when I was working for Governor Brown, I was the spokesperson for them, he actually used labor. Delegates from the UAW, delegates Jerry Werf, who is from AFSCME, they actually had promised $250,000 into my campaign to run against John Kasich, who is pro-NAFTA. And the notion at the time was that Clinton was being strategic, and he was just leaving it out because he was smart and it wasn't committing him, but he wasn't really committed to NAFTA. But I remember at the time, the small group of Brown delegates were saying, well, let's follow the money. He's getting all his money from the K Street trading crowd. He's getting money from Jackson T. Stevens out of Arkansas, who owns the 10th largest bank in the United States, who's pro-NAFTA and who lent him $2 million when he ran into trouble in New Hampshire with Jennifer with a G Flowers member. She said they had a long affair. So when it first was slipped into the Democratic platform, it was this notion of how crafty Clinton was, but he wasn't committed to it. And then he literally rammed it
comes
through.
Now, Margaret has been working really, really hard. Margaret Flowers has been working really, really hard here to stop the TPP. Now, I'm going to assume that the TPP is very much like NAFTA on steroids.
Much worse, probably.
Right. So then the question is, and Margaret, you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but, you know, we need a serious assessment here if Hillary Clinton is going to get into office and stick us with the TPP the way Bill did.
But I think what we have to be concerned is even before, you know, the next president comes into office, because our what we're hearing on the ground is basically that the White House is planning to push the Trans-Pacific Partnership ratification through Congress during the lame duck session this November. So that's the session that starts right after the elections and goes until the winter break. And generally, that's the time when members of Congress are not held accountable to the voters, because those who have lost their seats, you know, no longer care. You know, they can vote however they want to vote. And so, and it's the head of the Chamber of Commerce recently, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Tom Donahoe, was heard saying, we only need enough people to vote it plus one, you know, to vote for it, to pass it plus one in case somebody dies on the way to the vote. So they know that they just need to squeak this by, and that's how they got fast-tracked. It took them a long time to get fast-tracked through Congress last year. They had to squeeze arms. They literally had corporate executives off of the floor of the Capitol pulling in members of Congress to make them promises, to twist their arms, to get them to vote for it. They actually President Obama himself made an emergency visit to the Capitol to meet with the Democrats to get them into line to support Fast Track. So that's the time that we really need to be focused on right now, is preventing a lame duck session.
God, why does Obama want the TPP?
Well, that's something that we've speculated about for a long time, and then I think it was David Lindorf that did a great piece not too long ago where he actually looked at what industries will be benefited by the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then he looked at President Obama's three presidential libraries that he's planning to build and who's on those boards, and he found that the people that are donating to build these libraries or on the board of the Obama Foundation are the same people that are going to benefit tremendously from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So the Obama administration has been very aggressive in negotiating and pushing for these three agreements that we talked about, in particular the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's going to mean huge amounts of money for multinational corporations as well as for President Obama's future, his foundation, jobs for his children, you name it.
God, don't they steal enough money? So what do we think, Bob Fitricus, what do you think Trump would do about the TPP? And how is this going to play out in the election?
Other than Bernie Sanders, Trump has been fairly far more on the left side than Hillary Clinton. Although he appears to be, as in many of his policies, a bit inarticulate, he seems to be talking about tariffs. He seems to be talking about traditional isolationism and nationalism. And he spoke out, at least when I've heard him on a few occasions, against NAFTA and the trade agreement. I think, he's a right-wing nationalist.
So I
think he would speak out logically against the TPP, even though there's been reports out there some of his business interests benefit from it.
So how is Hillary going to play this one now in the election? I mean, let's assume that the nominees are Trump and Hillary, although, Bernie just doesn't want to go away, which is spectacular. I mean, winning Indiana and... I'm sure there's plenty of liberal of the Hillary Democrats just want him to go away now. But this is going to be a huge issue. Like Bob, at the top of the hour, I said that the first thing out of Trump's mouth when he became the presumptive nominee was to say that Hillary stuck us with the worst trade deal ever. And I assume that he's going to play this card. I think the American public has come to understand how bad NAFTA really is. And I assume, Margaret, that's been helping us fight the TPP. But how does this play out in the election? Margaret, you want to jump in on that one?
Oh, did you want me to? So, it's interesting. I think that most people, it's confusing, and we talk about this all the time. I mean, we don't expect that Hillary, if she's elected, is going to be against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that she'll find some way to get it through in her administration. And Trump is really very unclear about when he says that he wants to renegotiate these deals. We really don't understand what it means by renegotiating. Like, what aspects would he renegotiate, and what really would be his goals for a next trade deal. So I think that the important thing that we want to impress upon people is that no matter who is elected in this election, it's really critical. We know that the next 4 years are not going to be policies that represent our interests or benefit us or really anybody around the world except those at the top. And so it's really important for us to continue to organize and mobilize and be ready to set the agenda. That's why mobilizing after the election during this lame duck session is so critical. If we can mobilize a mass of people and stop them from voting on the Trans-Pacific Partnership during the lame duck, then we can build on that to really move forward the agenda that we need for dealing with the climate crisis and all the other crises, economic, healthcare, you name it, that we're facing right now.
Okay, well, I'm gonna jump off a cliff here, and I'm gonna tell you right now
flat out, that if I looking back on what happened in the 8 years of Bill Clinton's presidency, if I had it to do over again in 1992, I would have voted for Ross Perot. I mean, it would have been very hard for me to vote for George H.W. Bush under any circumstances. But given what Clinton did on NAFTA and on the drug war, and a lot of the other stuff he did, I think Bill Clinton was a catastrophic president. Absolutely catastrophic. As bad as any we've had, except maybe for George W. Bush and Richard Nixon. But, I mean, in category B, in terms of bad presidents, he was responsible for more people being arrested than anybody else, and he was responsible for NAFTA. So now we got this race here between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Now, you're saying, Margaret, and I think it's very important that we really have to work in this lame duck session against our own Barack Obama, for God's sakes, you know, who's wanting to stab us away with the TPP. I think it's probably less likely that assume we get through the lame duck session, it's probably less likely that the TPP would pass under Donald Trump than it would under Hillary Clinton. Is that correct? Bob, what do you think?
Well, from what they've said, I think you're right. I think Trump, because of his nationalism, because of his base of support, which is really a hardcore 15-20% of the population that have probably been harmed the most by this, people that he's bringing back into the process, he seems to have indicated he's opposed to these free trade agreements. You know, he thinks China took us to the cleaners regarding favored nation trade status. So I can't imagine he'd want to throw the Chinese over for the Vietnamese, who seem to be one of the great beneficiaries of this agreement.
Well, I'd like to build off of something that you said, Harvey. You said that if you looked back, that you would have voted for Ross Perot. And I think, you know, there are more than two presidential candidates in this race. We know that Jill Stein is the presumptive nominee for the Green Party. And we are kind of in this unique position where, for the first time in the last 75 years, the majority of voters in this country are neither Republicans nor Democrats. Republicans are 21% and Democrats are 29%. And so we've actually been pushing, and I'm not holding my breath that he would do this, but Jill Stein has said she's open to it, to a Sanders Stein presidential ticket. And I think we're in this really unique moment where the Republican Party and the Democratic parties are really weak, and it would be great to have somebody out there, a strong ticket, that's opposed to this whole neoliberal agenda that we're suffering from.
Yeah, the liberals aren't holding, Harvey. I think a Sanders Stein ticket could win a three-way race.
Would Bernie do it?
I can't believe. I mean, he should. You look at his entire history, he's never, you know, he's caucused with him, but he's always been independent. He was third party, right? He came out of, you know, Liberty Union Party there. And he's a democratic socialist. I mean, his lasting legacy would be to leave an actual third party in the U.S. that's progressive and environmental.
That's absolutely right. He's shown that he can get, you know, he can make a lot of money off of small donations. He would go a long way to build the alternative. The question is he going to have the courage to do that? And I think it's the only thing that would have integrity for him to do that. If he either throws the whole thing to Clinton or just drops out without endorsing really anybody, then he kind of defeats this whole political revolution mentality that he's been pushing. But if he did break with the Democrats and go on a, you know, independent ticket, a green ticket with Jill, I think that would be tremendous.
Well, I got to tell you, I did not enter this radio show with that in mind. But, you know, given our experience from 1992, and I will, you know, again, I will reiterate. I mean, I'm writing a history of the United States, and I'm having the deal. It's going to be done by January. It's called America at the Brink of Rebirth, The Spiral of U.S. History. And looking at the Clinton presidency, it was a catastrophe.
And there's no reason to believe that Hillary is going to be any better. Bill Clinton's presidency was an absolute disaster. I would have to say that the United States of America would have been better off if George H.W. Bush had been reelected. He would not have done the drug war the way Clinton did, and I don't think he could have gotten after it, because only a Democrat could have gotten after through. You know, a Republican was going to have opposition from the Democrats. The Democrat Clinton was able to get the Republicans behind NAFTA and then to split the Democratic Party. Hillary will do exactly the same thing. I don't think there's any doubt that if she gets in, there will be a version of the TPP. And, you know, if we can stop it, God willing, in the lame duck. So what you say, you know, it makes 100% sense. I mean, Bernie has to run with Jill. Have they been out? Did they do dinner? Have they gone out together? What's the deal?
So far, you know, the Stein campaign has been reaching out to him for a while, and he has not been willing to sit down and talk to her. I think that there are a lot of people that have expressed support for this type of a ticket, but it is really going to, if we want this to happen, we're going to have to really put pressure on Bernie. And there is a group called Bernie or Bust that is coming to this conclusion as well, and it has a petition, and they've got tens of thousands of signatures on that. But I think it really is up to all of us to tell Bernie that it's time to continue the political revolution outside of the Democratic Party.
Well, hallelujah for that. I mean, you know, if there's no other motivation for Bernie to run independently, it should be the TPP. I mean, there is no single piece of legislation or no single treaty that's done more damage to this country than NAFTA that I can think of. Can you, Bob, or Margaret?
Well, yeah, Suzanne and I, you know, Suzanne Pastor, my wife, we made a 12-minute video. We went down and saw the maquiladoras, and, you know, the conditions were just unbelievable, these free trade zones. We've also, you know, saw them in El Salvador as well. And where I'm from, Detroit, I mean, talk about patterns of investment and disinvestment. I mean, it put the final rusty nail in the rust belt. Absolute disaster in terms of the debt, and also absolutely non-sustainable, right? We have to have our toilet seats made in China. We can't make them in the United States anymore. So, you know, it's hard to imagine a worse agreement other than the TPP. But also, I mean, these people are the DLC. They're the Democratic Leadership Council. They are socially liberal corporate capitalists. They represent the 1%. They do it as blatantly as the Republican Party, but they get away with it because they're socially liberal. And it really needs to be stopped. That's why there needs to be a Sanders-Stein ticket.
Well, I'm for that. You know, that's not what I expected from this show. But, you know, Bob, I think our next article should be the TPP is why Bernie needs to run with Jill. I mean, it's, you know, there's no, in the last 25 years, there's been no more devastating reality than NAFTA. Margaret Flowers, will you tell people how to get a hold of you? We're almost out of time. People have to write you, and please.
Sure thing. So we have a campaign that we started a number of years ago called Flush the TPP, back when people couldn't remember what it was, and we just said it's like toilet paper plus. We need to flush it. So flushthetpp.org. They have a campaign called the No Lame Duck Uprising. People can go to that website and register for the No Lame Duck. We just launched it a couple weeks ago. We have almost 600 people that have registered, and our goal is to get tens of thousands by the lame duck so that we really have enough to put some real pressure on Congress and stop them from passing this. It's critical. If we stop the TPP, then we can stop the two other bad trade agreements, and we can show Congress that there's no way they can continue with this failed model, that we need a new model of trade that protects people and the planet. So go to flushthetpp.org, and my contact is on there.
All right, very good. And Bob, you want to direct people to the Free Press?
Freepress.org, where you can read Harvey Wasserman and myself, among others. So check out freepress.org.
And our new book, Strip and Selection 2016, Margaret, we'll get you a copy of that. We are now officially conspiracy theorists, Bob and I, but, you know, what can we do? We'll have to come back on that one. So I am totally for this. I think we got to push ahead. I'm going to have Joe on next week. Margaret and Bob, you're both invited to join us if you want. But this is serious stuff. And, you know, I am, again, so grateful that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee and not Paul Ryan. That was a terror to me. But that he has raised the NAFTA issue immediately at the top of the campaign, I think really, really says it all. Anything you two want to say before we get kicked off the air here?
Yeah, like Bernie Sanders. I mean, what they're hoping is that Bernie does what the Reverend Jesse Jackson did and Jerry Brown, mobilized a bunch of grassroots people, and then it all dissipates. If Bernie is going to have a lasting legacy, and if he's to be worthy of the picture of Eugene V. Debs in his office, he needs to form a progressive third party and restore America in the truest sense, not in the Trump sense.
All right, that's our next article. Margaret, yeah, I'll give you the last word. Just go ahead.
I just want to thank you both for the work that you do and for having me on, and also remind your listeners that I'm running for U.S. Senate, and you can check out flowersforsenate.org, and I look forward to continuing this conversation and really pushing for the Sanders-Stein ticket. I'm excited about that as well.
Well, if Jill can join us, I'll have her back next week, and you guys can call in if you want, okay? So this has been a great show. Thank you very, very much. Thanks to the crew in New York. Margaret, I look forward to seeing you in the Senate. Bob is going to be our county prosecutor, and we will move ahead. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, once again, from PRN.FM. We're moving ahead, and join us on the Sanders-Stein presidential ticket.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got...